True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
Hi, I'm Dick.
Today's episode is sponsored by Rover, the nation's largest network of five-star pet sitters and dog walkers. For $25 off your first booking, visit rover.com/brewery and use promo code BREWERY at checkout. When 17-year-old Amy Billig disappeared in 1974, her mysterious absence created a life-altering void. Amy's loved ones, especially her mother Sue, would never be the same. But Amy's story is about so much more than pain and loss. It's about the lasting qualities of courage, hope, and bravery after a mother's biggest nightmare come true. Like the parents of missing children all over the world, Sue Billig was left without her daughter, left to wonder and imagine all of the terrible things that may have happened to her. After being lied to, misled, ignored, and manipulated, her faith in humanity did not falter. After the many cruelties directed at Sue, she never gave up on Amy. And she never decided that no one would help her find Amy, even after her money, her pride, and her good health were taken from her. Sue Billig began investigating her daughter's case immediately after Amy disappeared. She received tips from people who claimed that Amy had been abducted by members of motorcycle gangs that traveled through the Coconut Grove area of Florida in that year, 1974. Some people claimed that Amy was alive, and others claimed she had been killed. Sue was led on a chase throughout the U.S. and even into Great Britain over the next years. Sue began receiving harassing phone calls. One caller actually tormented her for 21 years, until 1995, when FBI agents were able to identify the man by tracking his cell phone. Before, he'd always used a payphone to harass Sue, which made it impossible for them to find him. The caller was identified as Henry Johnson Blair, who worked for the U.S. Customs Department. Blair claimed he was an alcoholic and had obsessive-compulsive disorder, which caused him to harass Amy's mother. He said that he'd never actually met Amy, and he knew nothing about her disappearance. The addition of Blair into this case brought renewed attention to a man Amy had described in her journal. Amy wrote that she was considering running away to South America with a man she called Hank. A photo developed from a roll of film in Amy's camera showed a white van which was identical in color and model to a van that Blair drove back when she went missing. Blair's job with the Customs Department required him to relocate to South America around the time that Amy had mentioned him in her journal. At The Quiet End today, we're taking a look inside the hell that families of missing persons endure by examining the case of Amy Billig and especially the struggles of her mother, Sue Billig.
So how about a beer to do this?
That's a great idea. Let's do that.
All right. A nice Florida beer. Pulp, brewed by Civil Society Brewing out of Jupiter, Florida. It's an American pale wheat ale, although it kind of looks like one of those New England IPAs, but it is a wheat ale.
Okay.
So anyway, cloudy, honey-colored, very thin white head, not much there. Not the most attractive-looking beer. Nice aroma, both citrus fruit and tropical fruit. And when you take the first few sips, you hit lemon first, then some passion fruit, and orange peel. Very nice beer.
Sounds pretty good. Sounds very Florida-ish.
It does, hasn't it? It's kind of medium-bodied and a pretty nice beer to drink. So let's take some down and open it up for the denizens of the Quiet End.
Okay, let's do it. Here we go. I'm going to try this beer because I've never had it before. And I'm going to let you start out telling people about Amy Billig and her mom and all that her mom went through.
Okay, you have a couple sips of beer, then we'll get back to you. So March 5th, 1974... was a beautiful spring day in the historic village of Coconut Grove, Florida. The Grove, as the people who live there called it, was a neighborhood of shops, art galleries, and cafes, and one of Miami's most popular spots for tourists and artistic types. About 250 miles to the north in Daytona Beach, Bike Week was scheduled to begin. You ever been to Bike Week?
No, I haven't.
Kind of scary.
Okay.
Bikers. So all day long, motorcycle clubs rode through the town of Coconut Grove. Most of the members were burly guys wearing jeans and leather jackets with skull and swastika patches. Their arms were tattooed with snakes, devils, and images of death. Many of these guys were vets who had learned to kill in the jungles of Vietnam. Many also had lengthy rap sheets for violence, drug dealing, extortion, and murder. They're all heading north to the big week in Daytona.
Yep.
Now, Paul Branch was 6'2", and he could hold his own in any bar fight. He had reddish-brown hair, a beard and mustache, and tattoos running up both arms. Some of his tattoos had been erased with battery acid that left scarred patches of skin. Paul was a full-fledged member of the Pagan bike group.
Right. Now, Sue Billig would remember that day as an ordinary school day. Her daughter Amy, 17, had stayed up late the night before at a friend's house to watch one of their friends, a comedian, debut on a TV show. She hadn't come home until 3:20 in the morning, which had caused a small argument with her mother, who'd been really worried. School started at 8 a.m. also. Now, Amy arrived late to breakfast, but she didn't look too tired to start off her day at school. She was 5'5", 102 pounds, with long, thick, dark hair and long, skinny legs. Her oval face, combined with dark, almond-shaped eyes and her pretty smile, got her plenty of attention from the guys around town. Now, she planned to spend that summer in Manhattan after she graduated high school, where she would visit a friend who played in the Broadway show Hair, and then she'd decide if she wanted to go to drama school. She played the guitar, and she was a classically trained flutist. She loved Judy Collins and Joni Mitchell, and she had her own similar type of folk sound. Amy got musical talent from both of her parents, the family, parents Ned and Sue, and Amy and her younger brother Josh had moved to Coconut Grove from New York, actually to get away from all of the crime in New York. In Manhattan, Ned, a World War II vet with a Purple Heart, was a well-known trumpet player who played in Greenwich Village nightclubs. Sue was an accomplished singer who had met Ned when she was on a gig. And Sue's father had been a concert pianist. So very talented musical family.
Sounds like it.
They were very artsy.
Now Amy was Ned and Sue's miracle child. She was born after 10 years of trying, 5 miscarriages. Then baby brother Josh arrived a year later. On a trip to Coconut Grove in 1968, Sue fell in love with the place. She loved the art galleries, the cafes, the trees, the peace and quiet. She called Ned back in New York and said, "Honey, we're moving here." Ned and Sue had created a niche for themselves in the Grove. Ned opened a popular art gallery, Dimensions, and Sue made it quite a nice living as an interior designer. They soon had a large group of friends in town. Amy also loved the place. In a letter to a friend, she wrote, "New York is so ugly. Let me show you some of the prettiness of Coconut Grove. Old stone houses and fruit trees and blue waters and sunsets that will blow you away." Amy's mother, Sue, believed that Amy had an intelligence, wisdom, and maturity beyond her years. It sounds kind of crazy these days, but Amy never thought twice about hitchhiking. It was not only an accepted mode of transportation, it was a way to meet people. Many Europeans were still sightseeing America that way. While Sue often begged Amy not to hitchhike, Amy was convinced that her life was just a reflection of her attitude. If she saw only good in people, nobody would harm her.
And that's a common thing for young people to think before you get all tarnished by the world. You have these thoughts about the world.
Well, yeah, you're pretty innocent and naive.
Yes, absolutely. So that morning, Amy ate some toast and had a glass of orange juice before she left for school, and she called "I love you" to her mom as she walked out the door. It was a nice day. At noon, Sue and a friend went to a nearby beach to enjoy the sunshine. About 10 minutes after Sue left the house, Amy came home, driven from school by a friend, where she ate half of a yogurt and made plans to meet friends for lunch in Peacock Park. And that's a place where many of the young people went and they got together and played music and hung out. Amy called her father at the Dimensions Art Gallery and asked him if she could borrow a couple of dollars for lunch. She said she was supposed to meet Kirk and Kathy in the park, but she didn't have any money. So Ned said, sure, no problem. There was nothing unusual about this. The gallery was only a mile away in the village center, so it was an easy walk down the shady but pretty well-populated streets. It was a trip that Amy had made hundreds of times. But something unusual happened that day. At the crossroads of Main Highway and Poinciana Street, near where the family lived, Amy, already a little bit late for her lunch date, stuck out her thumb as she walked towards town. A group of construction workers building a house on the corner, whom Amy always greeted, remembered her walk by wearing a blue miniskirt and platform sandals. During that day, several motorcycle groups were thundering through town, where they would meet at the Grove's Diner, Key Marina, on their way to Bike Week. The mid-70s were very big for bikers. The three main bike groups had divided the country. The most famous, the Hells Angels, were centered in California and the West Coast, all the way up to Alaska. Florida was mostly outlaw territory, but the Pagans, with a few clubhouses across the state, and having control of Virginia, the Carolinas, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, were tolerated in Florida, so that the outlaws would be allowed passage to their territories in Canada. So altogether, the clubs were making millions of dollars. They were renting themselves out as muscle to the mafia, manufacturing and selling crystal meth, and running drugs and guns from one place to another. The women who were with them were owned. They were bought and sold like objects. They were traded for credit cards or a bike, and often forced into prostitution, or to dance in strip clubs and earn money for the men. So I think this is around the time, Dick, when the Hells Angels were actually bouncers at some of the concerts, right?
Right. Remember they were working the Stones concert.
I remember something vaguely. What was it that happened?
People died.
From the Hells Angels killing them?
Yes. The concert got a little out of hand, and the Hells Angels injured and actually killed some people.
And they were hired by the Rolling Stones to be there.
I don't know if they were hired specifically by the Stones or by the production company.
Oh, right.
But yeah, they were there to protect.
Yeah, that seems like a stupid idea, because they were criminals, right?
It does seem stupid in retrospect, doesn't it?
Did any of them end up getting arrested, do you know?
I don't remember.
Yeah, but it's kind of a famous story.
It is.
Yeah, it's well known.
Now, most of these bikers had long rap sheets.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's why I don't understand why you'd want them to be bouncers.
A new recruit spent a year as an associate before becoming a full-fledged member. Now, to graduate to being a full-fledged member, a major crime, such as murder, had to be committed. Still, despite the drugs, the alcohol, and the crime, bikers were often highly intelligent people. Though many were high school dropouts, others were educated men who hated boring society. Big Jim Nolan, the Outlaws' president, had been valedictorian of his high school. It seemed to be an appealing life for people who couldn't fit into society. In many ways, bikers were feared and admired by regular guys for rebelling against authority.
Well, yeah, they're the ultimate rebels in the movies, right? Rebel Without a Cause.
You bet.
No, not Rebel Without a Cause. What's the one with Marlon Brando?
Wild Bunch.
That's kind of, I think they're different now, though. I think a lot of the bike clubs now have working people who just buy their Harleys and go out on the weekends.
Yeah.
So I think it's a different scene now than in the 70s.
Oh, definitely.
That's why I really wanted to set the stage here for what it was like.
Yeah, even celebrities like Willie Nelson, Jerry Garcia, and the Stones, the Rolling Stones, hung out with bikers. And journalist Hunter S. Thompson hung out with the Hells Angels in the mid-60s and wrote a book about it. I think he got beat up by them, too.
Yeah, I read something about that, too. Dangerous group.
Yeah, not a group to mess with.
So that kind of sets the scene for giving us the idea of how panicked Sue was to think of her daughter being in these groups. It's not the place where anyone would want their daughter to end up.
Mm-mm.
No. So on March 5th, Sue returned home in the late afternoon. She'd left the house at noon, and according to Ned, Amy had called him at 12:10, which meant that Sue had only missed her daughter by a few minutes. She was supposed to come by and pick up a couple of dollars, Ned said. She must have decided she didn't need it. Amy had confidence and was given a lot of freedom from her parents because she was very responsible. She was allowed to stay out late and do what she chose to because she always got her homework done and she always called to check in. So by that evening, Sue was very nervous. No member of their family ever missed dinner without at least calling. So after Ned got home, the Billigs called a Miami police detective friend, Mike Gonzalez. This was at 8 p.m. So Gonzalez visited on his way home from work and questioned Josh about Amy, asking, is there any possibility Amy could have run away? And Josh said never. And Sue agreed. Sue said, we're the kind of family that other kids run away to. They don't run away from here. Gonzalez knew that more than 99% of children who are reported missing have only missed a telephone call and show up again on their own. So he was very calm. This was not a big deal to him. This was just kind of a favor he was doing for friends to help calm them down. He said, she's probably just out with friends. Don't panic. Just call again if Amy isn't home by morning. So Sue spent all that night worrying. She tracked down Amy's friend Kathy on the phone, and Kathy said, tell her I'm mad at her. She stood us up for lunch, and she's got my shoes from last night to boot. So after spending a sleepless evening, Sue became frantic. At 6 a.m., she called Mike Gonzalez again. She said, now I'm panicking. Amy is missing. But still, you know, this was a more innocent time, and despite Gonzalez's friendship, the police were considering Amy a low priority, probably a runaway. Sue told them over and over again that Amy would not run away. Her daughter wouldn't have run away because there was no reason for her to. She had her freedom. She had everything she wanted at home. She was a good girl who was looking forward to graduating high school in just 2 weeks. But they really weren't able to convince them.
No, they weren't. And in the first few months after Amy's disappearance, Miamians, particularly Groveites, flocked to the Billig home, offering to help look for Amy. This was long before Ted Bundy, before Christopher Wilder, before Danny Rowling, before Adam Walsh, Tiffany Sessions, and Shannon Melendi. It was when people tended to think that only the very rich or the very poor had to deal with the abduction of a loved one, not the people in the middle.
How long before Ted Bundy was this? Wasn't it around the same time?
Shortly before.
Oh, okay.
Not very long.
No, because Ted was in the 70s.
Right.
And Adam Walsh was in the 70s. But this was near the beginning of that kind of thing, I guess.
It was.
And of course, back then they didn't have the Amber Alerts. And
no, that was 20 years.
20 years later?
Later.
Okay.
When it finally happened. You know, they in the 70s, they treated disappeared kids a lot differently than they do now.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, I mean, you mentioned Adam Walsh. That was just an abduction.
Yeah, yes, it was. Out and out.
But and if it wasn't for his father, who went on a crusade, you'd probably never hear anything about Adam Walsh.
Probably not. That was the one that was like in a Sears at the mall.
Yeah.
I think he was with his mom shopping, and she left him to play video games with a group of kids there. You know how they'd have the setups where the kids could try the new video games.
Right.
And when she came back, he was gone. And that was terrifying. I remember, I must have been a little kid then, because I remember hearing about it and being really scared. Because I was always left in the store, you know. My mom would go in one department, leave me in the other department. It wasn't unusual.
Yeah, why not?
Well, now we know why not.
We do.
Because we know that Adam Walsh was horribly murdered.
He was, but it wasn't big news at the time.
No.
In that sense.
But of course, Adam Walsh was a small child. Amy was 17.
Yeah.
Which is a whole different story. A lot of 17-year-olds do take off for a while.
Yeah.
70, she could have been out smoking pot, hanging out with her friends. I'm sure that happened a lot.
Oh, positive it did.
Yeah. It's just kind of amazing to me that they didn't listen. But then on the other hand, I can see why. Because it's not an unusual thing that has happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's take a little break here to talk about our sponsors before we get into what Sue's search entailed.
Okay.
Rover.com is the largest network of five-star pet sitters and dog walkers in North America. So whether you need in-home dog boarding, like people do it in their own house, pet sitting where they come to your house, someone just to come by and walk your dog, or doggy daycare, Rover connects pet parents with dog people who will treat your pets like family. And Rover's really choosy about who's approved as pet sitters, only 20% of applicants are ultimately accepted to become Rover pet sitters. We've mentioned before our kind of problem dog, Sadie, whom we love, but we know that she's a tough case. But on Rover, we found the right sitter for Sadie. And she was so patient with Sadie, they ended up actually becoming buddies, which is a big relief to us, because that takes a lot of worry away. Rover's iOS and Android app are easy to use, too. You search, you book, you pay right inside the app. So there's even an option where you can have pictures sent to you of your dog and sitter, along with maps of the walk they took, and some really crucial details like whether your dog had any pees or poops on the way.
Well, you gotta know that stuff.
I would imagine you could even get a picture of the poop or something if you're monitoring for GI issues.
Sure.
You could. So Rover also has free in-person interviews and meet and greets. They have reservation guarantees and 24/7 access to pet care professionals. To get $25 off your first booking, just visit rover.com/brewery and use promo code brewery during your checkout. That's $25 off your first booking. And that's by visiting rover.com/brewery and using promo code brewery.
And for those of you looking for the next fast-paced, nail-biting thriller, I recommend Hangman. This new novel by Jack Heath introduces a darkly mesmerizing anti-hero who fans of Dexter and Hannibal will love. A boy vanishes on his way home from school, and hours before the ransom deadline, the police still have absolutely no leads. Enter Timothy Blake, an FBI consultant with a knack for solving impossible cases. But his expertise comes at a price. Every time he saves a life, he takes a life. So facing a kidnapper more cunning and ruthless than any he's ever faced, Timothy is assigned a new partner from the Bureau. She happens to be a woman linked to his past and the dark secret he will do anything to keep. New York Times bestselling author Jeffrey Deaver described Hangman as brilliant, probably best to read with lights on and doors locked. Given two well-chewed thumbs up from Greg Hurwitz, Hangman will keep you awake long past bedtime. So check out Hangman to fill those Dexter and Hannibal-shaped holes in your life. It's already on Audible and everywhere books are sold. Visit bookclubbish.com to learn more about Hangman by Jack Heath and start reading or listening today.
And I'd like to recommend a new, very different podcast that's called Gossip. Gossip is the first ever comedic soap opera podcast from the mind of comedian and actor Alison Raskin. Alison is the co-creator of Just Between Us YouTube channel, and she's a New York Times bestselling author. In Gossip, three unlikely friends, Valerie, Mia, and Bethany, meet each week at the Golden Cup Coffee Corner to dish about the latest rumors floating around their not-so-traditional suburban town, Golden Acres. And in Golden Acres, when the rumors are this juicy, it doesn't even matter if they're true. There's infidelity, epic fights, crazy sisters, and former bachelorettes. Girls go missing, there's murder, and maybe even a serial killer priest. Each week, you'll also learn more about the three women's juicy pasts as the story unfolds. If you're a fan of shows like Jane the Virgin, Desperate Housewives, or Big Little Lies, which I really enjoyed, you're going to love Gossip. Get the rumors now before you feel left out. Listen to episodes 1 and 2 of Gossip now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your shows. It's a fun podcast to listen to. Really different.
I might try it.
Yeah.
So the police made promises to the Billigs, but not much else besides the promises. They assured Sue and Ned that Amy would turn up, but they weren't searching for her, or not actively.
No, they think she's just going to turn up on her own.
So desperate, Sue and Ned turned to friends, who searched the neighborhood, posted signs with Amy's picture and her phone number on telephone poles. They looked through the bushes in the woods besides the roads, also looking for an injured body. Only 1 week earlier, a woman who had been hit by a car was found later in the brush. Josh, her brother, searched up and down the streets that he and Amy had walked together just a few days before. "I was so scared, but I forced myself to look into every bush, praying I wouldn't find her," he told a reporter later.
So while a missing child would really be front page news in almost any community now, it took until March 10th for the story to be in local papers. So that's 5 days?
Yep. 5 days.
The Miami News and the Miami Herald were the big papers. The Herald put the story on page 6 in the local section. a benefit concert by Poplar Grove musicians raised $850, which started an expense fund at the local Coconut Grove Bank. There was a $1,000 reward that was advertised in the local media. And that doesn't sound like much money now. But just for comparison's sake, you could buy a new Mustang for $2,800 back then. So I'm guessing $1,000 was kind of like $20,000 in today's money estimate. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Okay. So once the reward was offered, tips began coming in. One caller insisted that he had seen Amy riding in a green Jeep. Another said he had seen her get into a white van. Green Jeeps were hunted all over the city. Sue and Ned contacted a private investigator, Frank Rubino, a former Secret Service agent, to help with the search. The family begged the FBI to get involved. But without any evidence that Amy had been kidnapped, and without a formal request from local police, the agency couldn't become involved. While Sue remained certain that Amy had not run away, she did call friends all across the country to keep an eye out for her, just in case she showed up somewhere. At a certain point, you're hoping she did run away, because that would be the lesser of the two evils, for sure.
That's for sure. Ned, her father, seemed strong and steady on the outside, answering the phone with a voice often steadied by the increasing amounts of alcohol he was drinking. So he's not coping well.
No, inside he's really a wreck.
Now Sue, both outwardly and inwardly a nervous wreck, would stare out the windows all night long, looking, watching. And whenever she could fall asleep, she'd have nightmares about Amy. Now, so many tips and false leads were coming in that the police had brought in a tape machine to record phone messages. Now, the very first time someone called with a tip, and they said that Amy had been picked up by a motorcycle gang, this seemed like a promising lead. The biker gangs that had come through the Grove the day of Amy's disappearance were still fresh in everybody's mind. A caller said that they were holding her against her will. Now, Ned gave the caller Mike Gonzalez's phone number at the Miami police station. Ned assured her, "He's a friend who's been helping us." Now, Gonzalez was optimistic when he phoned the house after he'd spoken with the caller. She was worried that he would trace the call. She sounded sincere to him. It might have sounded vague. She promised to go back to her friend and get more information. They were supposed to be camped out with Amy around Titusville, Florida. The information became more ominous. They found out two girls were being held for white slavery. This story had a ring of truth and was corroborated by what the police knew about the outlaws and their recent movements. They had been through the Grove, and they were known to kidnap and sell women. Now, Amy would have been quite the prize.
Yeah, a young, pretty girl. But this biker connection really intensified as the first real evidence was found. A man named David Hemming called, and he had found a camera with Amy's name on it at the Wildwood off-ramp of Florida's Turnpike. His mother lived in the Grove and had recognized the name on the camera. Wildwood was a small town on the Turnpike that was just north of Orlando. It was on the route that a bike gang would take, traveling north to any of the interior states from Daytona. Hemming hand-delivered the evidence to the Billig house. No one could remember the last time they had seen her cheap plastic camera. It may have disappeared before Amy had, for all they knew. There were four exposed photographs on the cartridge, and they wondered, had Amy thrown it out as a clue, or had a kidnapper thrown it away because it was incriminating evidence? Strangely, the camera was found on the southbound side of the road, though, and if the bikers were headed north, which authorities knew, then why was the camera on the southbound side of the road? Kind of shocks me that they would bring the camera right to the family. Why didn't the police intercept this and at least try to get fingerprints or something? I know there was no DNA testing at that time.
That's interesting. I guess because the police weren't that interested.
Well, it really shows you that they weren't, I guess. Did he call the police with this information and the policeman said, just take it over to their house?
Yeah, I wonder.
Very strange. I mean, they do seem so laid back about it. I understand she was 17 and they think she was a runaway, but it just doesn't seem like they did their due diligence with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Sue had the film developed.
Yeah, and when she picked up the film the following afternoon, three slides were completely overexposed, and the fourth slide showed a wall with vines growing up it. And there was a white pickup truck parked in the background. Now, dozens of people were coming in and out of the house. So many, in fact, that Sue forgot that bikers were scheduled to stop by that evening. So she opened the door and was shocked. Two bikers were standing there, each over 6 feet. One weighed over 300 pounds. Her first words were, "My God, you're huge." Now, her heart was pounding in her chest. She nervously ushered the bikers into the den. And these guys were wearing crusty, dirty old jeans. When they turned around, she saw big switchblades poking from their back pockets. Over sweaty t-shirts with the Harley logo, they wore black jackets that read "Outlaws" across the back. They wore muddy black boots with steel toes. So they sat on the couch, and one with this long, tangled hair, who wore a huge Star of David, introduced himself in a New York accent as Sid Fast. The other wore a big gold cross and called himself Greek. Sue wanted to faint, thinking that bikers like these might have her daughter. Yeah, wouldn't you think so?
Yeah.
Holy cow. They asked Sue if she thought Amy would willingly get on a bike. Sue was unsure. She couldn't see her doing that, but she might have if she thought she recognized one of her friends from the Grove. She was very sweet and trusting. She always said mosquitoes didn't bite her because they knew she loved them.
Oh, boy.
Wow. Yeah. She would never think someone would be out to harm her.
So she was super sweet and naive. Oh, boy. That would make her such an easy victim, easy prey.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So these bikers said that the women they picked up usually came of their own accord, or they'd come to a party and get high. They would then keep them doped up, and the whole gang would have sex with them, kind of like an initiation.
That's not anything a mom wants to hear.
I don't think so. And after they get them hooked on drugs, they usually stayed with the bikers.
Well, yeah, if they're addicted to drugs, they're going to stay where the drugs are. It's really sad.
Yeah, so Sue patted one of the bikers on the knee and asked him, "Please don't speak that way about Amy." She wasn't a nun, but she was a sweet girl. Now, Sue assured the bikers that she wouldn't prosecute anyone. She just wanted to get her daughter back.
Yes, all the people that she visited, all she went through looking for her daughter, one of the first things she'd say, right, would be like, "I'm not the heat," because she didn't want anyone to think that they were going to get in trouble, because she just wanted her daughter.
Right.
A story about a possible outlaw connection was in the newspaper the next morning. After that, the phone never stopped ringing. Over 50 calls came in from psychics. Mostly they'd say they saw her near water. A famous psychic claimed that for $5,000, he could pinpoint where Amy was. And Sue, I give her credit, she didn't believe him. There were just opportunists everywhere, very attracted to this case, because the parents were desperate. The AP Wire finally picked up the story, and old friends started calling from around the country. Sue wasn't eating and quickly lost weight. It quickly became apparent that the outlaw's information was totally bogus, maybe even purposefully made up misinformation. So Sue was in tears over that. Did the outlaws have Amy, but they weren't going to give her back? Or did they never have Amy to begin with? Had they hurt Amy? Was Amy dead? Could the news article have spooked them, and she lost her only chance to get her daughter back? You know, all this is running through her mind. It's just a living hell. On the strength of the outlaw tip and the fact that the bikers had apparently crossed state lines, Sue spent a day downtown and actually convinced the FBI to look into the case. She was exhausted, but she still answered the phone no matter what. When the phone rang at 9 a.m., it wasn't the first time it had rung that morning. Usually the calls were from friends in New York who just heard the news. Sometimes it was just a sympathetic woman calling to say that they were praying for her family. The most frustrating were the well-intentioned callers that gave outrageous information and tips, saying they'd seen Amy working as a waitress in Jamaica, that she was living on a sailboat, or that she was a prostitute at a Miami hotel. Now, these are people that just saw people that looked like her, I guess.
Sure.
And, you know, like I said, they were well-intentioned, but just caused a lot of heartache.
Oh, absolutely. And there's heartache all around her.
Yes.
And she kept getting her hopes raised and then dashed.
Yes, absolutely she did.
So one example is these teenage twin boys who lived in Miami. They tried to get money from Sue by saying they had Amy. These are the Glasser twins, Larry and Charles. They were 16 years old and had never even met Amy because she attended a different high school. They were from a well-off family and lived with their divorced mother. Neighbors described the twins as good kids, and their school records were spotless. They never explained what had sparked their actions or what plans they had for the money. They were released into their mother's care, and in court, they showed no remorse for their actions. They sat in the defendant's chairs looking smug and smiling, insisting that the crime was just a prank. Calls made from the lobby were traced to the phone number of a friend who had no knowledge of the crime. The two teenagers had masterminded the plot by themselves. So there was one good thing about the incident, in that it brought the story of Amy's disappearance into the national spotlight, and it was soon front page news around the nation.
Others pulled cruel pranks, such as yelling "Mama, Mama" on the phone, but no one had the tenacity of the man who called himself Hale Johnson. Hale Johnson had an earnest-sounding voice. He introduced himself politely on the phone, saying he was from Fort Pierce and was staying at a local Ramada hotel on business when he read the latest article about Amy. So he said, "I saw a girl who looks very much like Amy hanging out with the bikers on Fisherman's Pier." There was something very practical and firm in his voice that made Sue believe that he was not the type that was crazy or just spreading false hope. She asked him, "Would you come down to the gallery that my husband manages in Coconut Grove and look at some photos there?" And he said, "I'd be glad to." He got the address and made the appointment for the following day, and Sue and Ned brought the photos into the store and waited for him, but he never showed up. When they called the Ramada Inn, they were told that no one by that name was registered. But then, just a few days later, Johnson called again, apologizing for standing them up. "Listen," he told them, "she will be posing for me and another artist in Fort Pierce on Thursday. If you want to see her, come by." So he gave her a phone number and an address, 913 Ohio Avenue, along with instructions on how to get there. Sue thanked him before she hung up. But as soon as she hung up, she turned to Ned and she said, "Something just isn't sitting right with me about this." So they called the number back. They dialed this number that Johnson gave them, and they received a recording saying that the number was no longer in service. So Sue called the Fort Pierce Police Department, and the officer she spoke to was familiar with her case and left to drive past that address, and he called back saying that there is no 913 Ohio Avenue. He had also checked and couldn't find any listing for a Hale Johnson. They contacted FBI agent James Franklin, who was in charge of that area, and Sue spent another sleepless night. The next day, she received another call from Johnson. "Why didn't you come?" he said. "She was there." And Sue said, "I came, but the address didn't exist. We were there." Sue said, "If you saw her, tell me how she looked." And Johnson said, "Oh, she's beautiful. Very nice body, and she's got great tits." "Don't talk like that. I'm her mother," Sue snapped. And then he just started getting even more disrespectful, saying she had a beautiful mouth and she knew how to use it, things like that. And this is how his calls would end up being, really inappropriate and hurtful.
Police traced Hal Johnson's calls and discovered they had been placed from four payphones in the Miami suburb of Kendall. But when they staked out a particular payphone, he never returned. And the police told Sue they didn't have the manpower to stake out all four payphones all night, until he called again. Johnson also seemed especially sneaky, like he could spot police surveillance. If they were staking out one phone, he would call from another, then hang up before police could arrive. Now, by 1985, the world had become a very different place since Amy's disappearance 11 years previously.
Sure did. The 80s were very different than the 70s.
The country's shift toward conservatism, with Ronald Reagan at the helm, had turned the age of Aquarius on its head. So teenagers rejected the old ideals of peace and love, traded in their blue jeans and flowers in their hair, and identified themselves with the material girl.
Madonna.
AIDS had changed everyone's ideas about the innocence of sexual relationships, and the war on drugs had forced small bands of drug smugglers to organize into large and dangerous organizations.
Sue appeared on Geraldo, The Today Show, and a lot of those other daytime talk shows, of course in the hopes of delivering her message to whoever might listen. The Billicks began to wonder if all their investigations during the years had been worthwhile, because Hale Johnson was continuing to call, and he did seem to know so much about Amy. He talked about her looks, he knew about her appendix scar, he knew the kind of music she liked, He knew where they lived, and he even seemed like maybe he was watching them. Did you get that impression from the phone call records?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So Hal Johnson would make sure they would never find peace, and he would never help them find Amy either. From day to day, year to year, there was always Hal Johnson. He'd say, "Do you know what Amy's doing to me now? She has such a great stomach, great muscles. She's keeping herself looking very nice." When Sue's mom died, Hal Johnson even called her and taunted her about that. So what a jerk, to put it mildly.
Yeah, just their own personal tormentor.
Yeah. You have any ideas on what you think makes a person do something like that? Is it a different kind of sadism where you want someone to suffer?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. That's the impression I got, too. I mean, there's a lot of talk about obsessive compulsive, but I know quite a few people who are obsessive compulsive.
That don't do this.
Maybe some under this very roof, and they're not like that.
There could be.
Yeah.
Now, Ned Billig, who tried to keep his art gallery open after Amy disappeared, as we said, started drinking heavily, and he lost the business. Brother Josh, who had been a good student, started to fail all his courses. He kept arguing with his math teachers over algebra and refused to work the algebra problems and dropped out of school before the end of the 11th grade. In the late 70s, Josh became a stonemason, a builder of walls to protect people.
And that's how he would describe his attraction to doing that sort of work.
Right. In the mid-80s, Josh bought some property in the woods near Naples, Florida. He built a cabin on it. He would go there with his parents, and they would cook outside and take long walks.
So this family was really, really destroyed.
They were.
Because these were kind of happy-go-lucky, artistic people.
Yeah.
Who are shells of their former selves.
Well, look what happened. I mean, the father is an alcoholic, his way of dealing with things.
Right.
Her brother dropped out of school.
It's good that he ended up doing that.
He did have a craft.
Yes.
But he was a pretty bright kid.
Yes, he was. And dropping out of school in the 11th grade. I mean, that wouldn't have happened if Amy hadn't disappeared.
Not at all.
No. Well, in 1992, Ned Billig learned he had cancer, and he actually didn't have long to live. He wasn't so afraid for himself, he told Sue, but leaving her behind. He said, "I can't leave you. You're going to be alone when that man calls," referring to Hal Johnson. So that's an evil thing that Hal Johnson's doing, if this man's dying and this is something he has to be worrying about. That's terrible. Earlier in the year, Sue had been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, but she had an operation that went pretty well and she was in remission, although she wasn't cured.
Right, but Ned wasn't a candidate for surgery. It was too far advanced.
Yeah, well, you know, Ned was pretty much a chain smoker, which got worse after Amy disappeared, of course.
Right.
Sue never smoked, but of course she lived in that house full of secondhand smoke.
She had the old secondhand smoke.
Yeah. Plus, they were musicians, and you know, all the bars back then were full of smoke.
Right.
So Sue, you know, tried to help Ned die more peacefully and told him not to worry about leaving her. She'd always had managed to keep going, and she would continue to do so. She would borrow money and install a security system in the home. And she thought, you know, maybe Johnson will take pity on us and stop calling. She didn't tell Ned what she really hoped, though, that Johnson would eventually tell them how to get Amy back and grant Ned's last wish to see Amy before he died. So even after those years, she still has that glimmer of hope that maybe he does know where Amy is. So on a cold January night in early 1993, Sue decided to make this request to Johnson. By now she doubted that he really knew anything about Amy, but she couldn't rule it out. So she'd tell him that if he did, now was the time to act like a real human being because Ned was really sick and his only wish is to see his daughter before he dies. So she thought, well, maybe if I put it to him that way, he'll speak the truth or just leave them alone. So the phone rang after midnight one night and she said, "I need to tell you my husband's very, very sick and I'm not well either. If you know where Amy is, you have to tell us now. It would mean everything to Ned to see Amy before he dies." And all he said was, "You'll be alone soon. Do you still have a nice shape?" Awful, huh?
He's just a horrible human being.
Yeah.
Ned died a few days before the 19th anniversary of Amy's disappearance. He was buried in the family plot Sue had purchased the year before when she'd found out that she had cancer. She had also purchased gravestones for Ned and herself and made Josh promise to put Amy next to Ned if her remains were ever found. The publication of Ned's obituary was a surprise to many in the community who didn't know he had been sick. Phone rang 2 weeks later. "Ned's dead, isn't he?" Hal Johnson said. "You're alone now, aren't you?" "What do you mean by that?" Sue asked. "Why do you keep taunting me? Please, leave me alone." Johnson's voice breathed heavily, and he said, "You better watch out."
So that's a threat.
Sounds like a threat to me.
It really does. When police did tell Sue that they finally arrested the man they believed had been calling her, she just began to cry. She broke right into tears. And once she started and she couldn't stop, it was such a relief. She cried for herself and she also cried for her family. But at least the torment was over. So tell me a little bit about who this asshole was.
This asshole is named Henry Johnson Blair. He's Hal Johnson. He was born in New Orleans in 1947 to a career Coast Guard father and a housewife mother. Now, the family moved frequently while Hank, his younger sister, and older brother were growing up. From New Orleans to Honolulu, from Honolulu to Miami, then to small towns in New York and North Carolina. In 1964, the Blairs returned to Dade County and settled in South Miami. Hank graduated from Coral Gables High School in 1966 and went on to Miami-Dade Community College and also worked as a tire installer at Sears. Hank's only A at the community college was in judo. After 2 years with a D-plus average, he went to the University of South Florida in Tampa, where he barely squeaked by as a history major. His only A there at USF was in behavioral psychology. And then after he graduated from college, he went to work for the U.S. Customs Department.
So Hank got married when he was 27, and that was around the time when Amy Billig was abducted. He lived with his wife Cindy in South Miami. He'd been a sky marshal until 73, which is an undercover customs agent who has a gun and rides on commercial flights in case there's a hijacking. Longtime friends of Blair's parents said they remembered him saying that he flew to the Caribbean and South America quite a bit. Police said that Cindy Blair told them her husband had made trips to South America, but she didn't remember exactly when. In March of 74, when Amy disappeared, Blair wasn't a sky marshal anymore. He was a customs patrol officer. So his job at that point was to drive around and patrol the local waterways. Police say both Blair and his wife either returned to Miami 10 days later or 13 days later when they went on their honeymoon in February of 74. So they didn't recall which. Amy was abducted on March 5th, and that was 12 days after their wedding. So it would be in the right range.
Could be.
Yeah. Several custom agents who spoke off the record said that they knew Hank Blair well and that he couldn't have been involved in Amy's disappearance. He was just too nice, they said, a totally nonviolent person. Gloria Halliday, who worked in the customs office with him in the 70s, described him as very mild-mannered. He was never macho, never a show-off, never full of himself like a lot of the guys in law enforcement were. Retired high school teacher Paula Richett, who bought a house from the Blairs in 1978, said that she had to do some unusual repairs to the house after Hank and Cindy moved out. The cast iron burners on the kitchen stove were broken, and the porcelain kitchen sink was actually shattered. Also, an inside door was bashed in. So she said she didn't know how any of it happened, but it did make her suspect that someone in that house had had some fits of rage, some tantrums where they broke things.
Sounds like it.
It kind of does, yeah.
Neighbors also said that Hank came and went at odd hours, often in the middle of the night, and he would explain to neighbors that he was a narc, a narcotics agent.
So that wasn't true?
Nope.
No.
He was known to wear disguises, fake beards, mustaches, wigs, sunglasses, hats, and he had a lot of guns.
Between 74 and 78, he owned an MG, but neighbors say that he also drove some vehicles that were seized by customs and were made available to patrol officers. One of them was a lightly colored pickup truck, and one was a beat-up beige van, which he would park in the backyard. Now, these vehicles would match witness descriptions of vehicles a girl who looked like Amy was seen getting into around the time of her abduction. But, of course, you know, there were reports with a lot of different cars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start.
Yeah, exactly.
So Hal Johnson kept any sense of normality from Sue's life. Even as she was grieving Ned's death and dealt with her own recurrences of cancer and chemotherapy, his calls were becoming more frequent. He told her he had Amy. He was training her as his sex slave. Sue would either hang up or get her hopes up, beg for more information. After so many trails that had turned cold, Johnson seemed to her the only road left to finding Amy. No matter how disgusting the calls became, there was one theme, and that was Amy was alive. So Sue notified local police and FBI agents of the continuing phone calls. These calls were still being made from telephone booths in the Miami suburb of Kendall. And as before, every time police arrived, no caller. He's gone.
Well, in 1993, a puzzling call came from Johnson, and Sue was able to keep him on the phone for several minutes. But in the end, the telephone company had no trace record for that call. Investigators then concluded that he must have been using a cell phone. Cellular telephones were especially difficult to trace. At the time, there were several dozen cell phone companies operating in Florida, and there was no technology available that could pinpoint where the calls originated. While a cell phone meant that some private user with a name, account, and ultimately a home address might be tracked, there was no judge who would issue any sort of what they call a shotgun subpoena for so many calls. Hale Johnson knew how well camouflaged he was. Now he could call from anywhere at his own convenience, so he was calling more frequently because of that, at all times of the day and night. And Sue didn't tell her friends about this constant harassment. She kind of kept it to herself, and it really was difficult for her.
Can only imagine. Henry Blair tormented Susan until 1995, when FBI agents were finally able to trace his cellular phone. Blair claimed that he was an alcoholic and had an obsessive-compulsive disorder, which caused him to harass Susan. He also stated that he never met Amy and knew nothing about her disappearance. In his confession, Blair blamed his calls on obsessive-compulsive behavior arising, he said, from the stress of his job. He claimed he had never sought psychiatric counseling because it might have wrecked his career. Just a bunch of crank calls is how he described his harassment, insisting that he would never act out on anything. The pressures would mount, I would call, and then it would subside. Blair was sentenced to a 2-year prison term for harassing Susan.
What do you think about that? I think that's not very long for what he did.
Yeah, that's all they found him guilty of. 2 counts of harassment, and he got 1 year for each.
What about the threat?
Yeah, I know.
Well, he probably didn't have a record, so it was his first crime. I think that probably turned things in his favor. I hope that he at least had to get some counseling.
I would make that a mandatory thing.
Yeah.
Right?
I would think so. Yeah, definitely. Before we get on to feedback, I just want to thank our listeners, our TieGrabber members, our Patreon supporters, and everyone who's taken the time to write to us. If you have feedback or a crime you'd like to suggest to us, why not leave a voicemail? You can click on Leave Us a Voicemail on our website, tiegrabber.com, or you can even record your feedback on your phone and email it to us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. So why listen to us read your feedback when we can hear it straight from you? That's all I've got to say about that. I would like to get more voicemails. We get voicemails saying really nice things about us, which is great, but most of our suggestions and comments on cases come in writing.
That they do.
So that's my plea for some more voicemails on that. If listening to True Crime Brewery is a positive thing in your life and you think you might enjoy an extra episode to listen to once in a while, you can offer us some support by joining Team TieGrabber at TieGrabber.com or by becoming a patron at Patreon.com/TrueCrimeBrewery. As a member, you'll get access to about 20 members-only TCB episodes and all the new ones that we release each month. When you join, we'll send you a bottle opener or a snifter, and I'll also throw in some cool pieces of swag for you. We have stickers, magnets, and coasters. And if you sign up, please make sure you check your junk mail if you don't get your email with your login instructions right away. Some other ways to offer us some support: follow us on Twitter at TieGrabberPods, on Instagram, or on Facebook. Also, if you have a few minutes to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast, that helps us out a lot too. All right, Dick, let's start feedback with you.
Okay, this is first one is from Gina L., and it's on the Texas cadet murder. Gina L. says, right off the bat, I don't know how you missed this, but from her autopsy, Adrienne was a virgin when she was killed. In an interview, the male killer confessed that it was a lie, that they'd had sex. I'm surprised you two missed this important piece of info. It was brought out in trial as well.
And this is only one. We got several letters about this, Dick, yeah. So I wanted you to address it.
So let me just figure this out.
Okay.
I'm going to assume that the reason people feel that she was a virgin was that her hymen was intact, because that's the only way.
Yeah, but we didn't find that on the autopsy report anyway.
We didn't. The autopsy report said there was no vaginal trauma and there's a tampon in place. So let's talk about the intact hymen.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So people assume that if that's the case, then the person is a virgin. But it doesn't work that way. So you can have an intact hymen and still have had penetrative sex without tearing the hymen. So an intact hymen does not necessarily mean that you're a virgin. And along those lines, you can have a torn hymen and still be a virgin. There's other things that can do that. Inserting a tampon could do it. Exercising, bike riding, there's a lot of ways to tear a hymen. An intact hymen, while it is a convenient way for people to say that that person is a virgin, doesn't have any credence at all. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second part that I'd address to Gina is that whether the male said they had sex or didn't have sex, I mean, there's different kinds of sex. So it didn't have to be penile vaginal intercourse. It could have been other things, oral sex, anal sex. But again, it really doesn't matter.
I really think it's a moot point.
The kid said they had sex.
Well, yeah, and whether they did or not really has nothing to do with the fact that she was murdered, other than the fact that that's the thing that was the motive, I guess, for Diane, the girlfriend, to tell him to kill her. But whether he was lying or telling the truth, I don't think it matters. And I guess what disturbed me, Dick, was some emails that suggested if Adrienne was a virgin, then it was somehow worse that she was murdered than it would have been if she wasn't a virgin. That upset me, and I think it's just completely irrelevant. Whether she had sex with him or not, she
totally
didn't deserve
irrelevant.
This.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
So is that, I guess they're probably trying to imply that it was a worse crime because she was a virgin?
Because they didn't have sex and she was a virgin, then it would be a worse crime.
Please.
I know. And I wouldn't even have brought it up if that was the only thing, but I wanted you to give us the medical explanation. I know you read the autopsy report, so obviously if it said that, you would have known that.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks for addressing that for us. I have comments from David on the Texas cadet murder. And David says, have either of you seen the movie Taps? It's about kids at a high school military academy, and it was released in 1981. In one of the scenes, the graduating cadet commander is conferring with the kid who will take his place as the cadet commander. Their dialogue is no different from what actual military men would say after a change of command, when the former cadet commander is called by his parents and gets in the back seat of the family car. The point I'm trying to make, rather badly, is how seriously kids involved in the CAP and junior ROTC take their roles as cadets and lose sight that they're still kids who can't vote, drink legally, or live without the support of their parents. Cadets take being the company commander, executive officer, operations officer, and personal feelings with perhaps more intensity than other kids their own age. They want to be grown up so badly and doing the real military grind, yet some of the kids lack the emotional infrastructure to handle the more adult feelings that their raging hormones bring. There is a structure within the weekly CAP meetings or daily JROTC classes, but not full-time like there is in the actual military. It is those gaps between putting on the uniform where problems can really be encountered. The cadet world is very insular. I played sports, and I took them very seriously, but nowhere near as seriously as the CAP or JROTC, as I was in both. Having been in that world, I can relate to David and Diane, and in my opinion, Diane had a major screw loose, and David was to his detriment morally weak. That emotional infrastructure that every other kid in the CAP and JROTC can find during times of personal crisis was missing in David and Diane, and a tragedy resulted. It's too bad they weren't mature enough to realize that shit like this happens to everyone, and realize how close Brian McMillan came to being sent to prison for the murder. Remember the boy who had the emotional problems and police had him arrested?
Yeah, kind of had a crush on Adrian.
So David says, just a horrible tragedy at every level.
Absolutely.
Oh, and I met my wife in the CAP too. Small world, question mark?
Yeah, but I bet you and your wife didn't kill anybody.
No. But I do remember Taps.
Yeah.
Yeah, good movie. Thanks, David.
Case suggestion from Cindy about Joseph Callinger. Callinger was arrested and imprisoned in 1972 when his children went to the police. While in jail, he had scored 82 on an IQ test and was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and state psychiatrists recommended that he be supervised with his family. Now, the children later recanted their allegations, however. 2 years later, one of his children, Joseph Jr., was found dead in the rubble of an old building. 2 weeks before the murder, Callinger had taken out a large life insurance policy on his sons. Though Callinger claimed that Joseph Jr. had run away from home, the insurance company, suspecting foul play, refused to pay out the claim. Then, beginning in July of 1974, Callinger and his 15-year-old son Michael went on a crime spree spanning Philadelphia, Baltimore, and New Jersey. Over the next 6 weeks, they robbed, assaulted, and sexually abused 4 families and murdered 3 people. They gained entrance to each house by pretending to be salesmen. On January 8, 1975, they continued their spree in Leonia, New Jersey. Using a pistol and a knife, they overpowered and tied up the 3 residents of a home. Then when others entered the home, they were forced to strip and were bound with cords from lamps and other appliances. This culminated in the killing of 21-year-old nurse Maria Fasching, who was the 8th person to arrive. When she reprimanded Callinger, he responded by slitting her throat. Finally, another one of the residents, still bound, managed to get outside and cry for help. Neighbors saw her and called the police, but by the time they arrived, the Callingers had fled, using a city bus as their getaway vehicle and dumping their weapons and a bloody shirt along the way.
Mm-hmm. So I put this case in our list of to-dos. I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Sounds like you got a whole family that's kind of nuts.
So I have some comments and case suggestions from MJ. Just writing to let you know how much I enjoy listening to your podcast. I have only recently found your podcast, but love the details included in each case, as well as your dry sense of humor without being over the top. You have a great mix of episodes, a lot of which I am not familiar with. And as an avid beer drinker, I love hearing Dick's critique of the different beers.
Thank you, MJ.
I am Australian, living in a smallish tourist town called Port Macquarie, population 60,000, which is 4 hours south of Sydney on the east coast of Australia. We don't have much crime in Port, but have the occasional murder. We do, however, have beautiful beaches and a few breweries with both beers and ciders. Well, it tends to get hot over here, so we need to quench our thirst. Might I suggest 3 Aussie crimes, which all have books written about them, that you might like to take a look at? Number 1, the murder of Alison Baden Clay by David Murray. Set in Brisbane, about the murder of a beautiful mother of 3. The husband did it, of course.
Well, that's in our queue.
Yes.
We're going to be doing that one.
Yes, a listener actually gave me a book about this one. So we are doing that one. The next one, number 2, is The House of Grief by Helen Gardner. Set in a small country town of Victoria, it's the story of a father who drives his three sons into a dam on Father's Day and only saves himself. Quite an interesting case, as the children's mother strongly defended the father at the beginning, but eventually had to admit he was guilty of murder. That does sound good.
It does.
The third one is The Vanishing of Peter Falconio by Richard Shears. Set in the Northern Territory, involving a couple of English tourists traveling around Australia in an old VW van who were supposedly pulled over by another car on an outback highway. The male tourist Peter has never been found, but was presumed murdered. The convicted murderer maintains his innocence to this day, and the female tourist, who escaped the ordeal, came under extreme scrutiny at the time. The book has an interesting take on the case, suggesting alternative reasons for his disappearance and the possibility that the convicted murderer is innocent. All three crimes received huge media coverage at the time of their court trials and would not be well known for a lot of Americans. Anyway, hope you are both well and keep up the great work. Here's hoping one day I get to shout you a beer at the quiet end. Cheers.
We would love that, MJ.
Yeah, thanks, MJ.
And those are, well, the first case, Allison Baden Clay, we're definitely doing. But the others are both pretty interesting sounding.
Yeah, I think I'll buy the books on Amazon. We can take a look at them.
Let's do that. Okay, I have a comment, a nice comment from Kid Dynamite.
Yeah, these I usually don't have us read, but this one was so nice, even though it's not a case suggestion. I want you to read it.
Okay. Jill and Dick, I started a new job in October last year after working from home for several years. I've always been a fan of crime stories, enjoy listening to them while driving. After finishing YouTube by January, I stumbled upon your podcast and have been hooked ever since. I love the way you lay out the stories and your calm wittiness, and sometimes the occasional F-bomb, make me feel like I am enjoying a well-reviewed craft beer down at the quiet end with both of you, as if we have been acquaintances for a decade. I've been telling everyone I know about your episodes and hope your awesome podcast bring you much success the further you go along. Well, that is very nice, isn't it?
I thought it was super nice, yeah. Thanks, Kid Dynamite. The way he spelled it, I think it's like Dynamite.
Dynamite. Which TV show was that?
Good Times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So I have an episode suggestion from Barb. On January 24th, 1999, 19-year-old Jackie Folkerts was brutally murdered in her home in Britt, Iowa. The crime shocked the small community. A year later, residents were again shocked to learn that lifelong resident, husband and father, was arrested and subsequently convicted of first-degree murder. Brad's mom and dad were well-respected and active members of their church, and I considered them among my closest friends. I also knew Jackie, though not well. There was a complex and ongoing relationship between Jackie and the Erdil family at the time of her murder. I believe you would find this an absorbing and grotesque case worthy of your analysis. I cannot tell you how very much I enjoy your podcast, particularly your respectful banter. I am a cancer patient with metastatic bone lesions, which can become quite uncomfortable. And as I do not wish to be routinely heavily medicated, I find True Crime Brewery to be a valuable diversion that routinely helps me rest, if not sleep, through some seemingly endless nights. I cannot fully express my gratitude, Barb. Now, this letter makes me want to cry. It's so sweet.
Very sweet.
I mean, just to say it becomes quite uncomfortable. I'm sure, Barb, that it's much worse than that.
Bone pain?
Yes.
Hurts like hell.
Yeah. And if we could be some little bit of help to that, I'm honored. That's just amazing. Thanks, Barb.
Thank you. Okay, Juliana with comments on the Spreckles Mansion mystery. I love listening to your podcast. There are so many true crime podcasts out there, but few that go into such depth, which for someone who has studied forensic psychology is the part I enjoy most. So I really appreciate all the research put into it. Juliana goes on to say, I'm outraged by this last podcast, The Spreckles Mansion Mystery. I'm dumbfounded that this could be considered a suicide, contrary to blatant forensic evidence. I am personally leaning towards Sam as the murderer. It is not uncommon that the perpetrator is either the last person to see the victim or to be the 911 caller.
I think maybe she meant Adam.
Adam.
The brother? I think she meant Adam.
With regards to the morning porn, it is strange. Many sex offenders have excessive sexual preoccupation, an obsession with sex and masturbation as a means of coping. Fantasy also plays such an important role for sex offenses. But fantasy is not the same as reality, so in the moment of an attack, it's common that the perpetrator cannot physically rape his victim because he's unable to achieve erection. There's no reason to believe this crime isn't sexually motivated. In fact, one of the criteria for sexual homicide is if the body is staged completely, partially nude. Anyways, it's a truly sad case. One last thing, in the feedback, Dick mentioned an assessment for psychopathy. I don't remember the name, but I've never heard of it. The leading assessment tool in the field is called the PCLR, which is Psychopathy Checklist Revised by Robert Hare. This is widely regarded as the most accurate measurement of psychopathy, in addition to being the best indicator of recidivism after release. An interesting item on the PCLR is about the dead look in the eyes, something I believe Jill spoke about on a previous podcast. The see-right-through-you effect that psychopaths have is a real lack of connection. If you're interested in learning more about how psychopaths behave, there's a classic book called The Mask of Sanity by Hervey Cleckley. I recommend it for less jargon-filled, more descriptive accounts. Snakes in Suits is also a good book for understanding the corporate or successful psychopath.
I love that title.
One last thing. Dick, have you tried or reviewed Le Chouf beer? I wasn't a beer lover until I went to Belgium, and this beer is my favorite, absolute favorite. The little gnome got to me, too. Well, Juliana, I've had two or three. Belgian beers are pretty good anyway.
They are. They make a great beer.
But yeah, I've had some by that brewery. Great beers.
So this was a great little learning session. I found it great, really fascinating letter.
Yeah, some good info. I want to check this Mask of Sanity book.
Yeah, we're going to get that and look at it.
Thanks, Juliana. Good stuff.
Yeah, very good. So Laura has some comments on the Spreckles Mansion mystery, too. Dear Jill and Dick, I'm fascinated by the tragic case of the Spreckles Mansion. I've heard it covered by a few podcasts, but it's always interesting to hear your take on things. One thing I want to put forward, maybe being a devil's advocate, but the remarks about the pornography searches, and specifically the anime porn, struck a chord with me. I live in Japan and have had extensive exposure and interest in Japanese pop culture, including the 2D porn in anime, games, and manga, all referred to in the West as hentai and in Japan as ero. The Zahu lawyer, Anne Bremer, is quoted as saying, "Never in a million years would she have those fantasies, and never in a million years would she even look at porn. There was somebody interested in doing her harm with these kinds of searches. It's a chilling coincidence that these are the searches made before Rebecca's death, but is it out of the question that she, as a female, might look at porn? Anime and lesbian porn may well be largely geared towards men, but I can attest to there being female fans because I am one of them. I think it's going a bit far to say never in a million years, because how would we know the secret desires of others? I agree it likely indicates the interests of someone other than her, but can we say she would never have looked at these things? I say no. The timing would be bizarre, but then what about this case isn't bizarre? That being said, I don't believe for a second that she committed suicide in this state. Anne Rule also drew a comparison between her bindings and the Japanese rope bondage shibari. Interestingly, red ropes are often depicted iro manga and used in real shibari. It feels that if there is a connection between the searches and her death, that someone was playing out a fetish slash fantasy. Anime is not a catch-all for a fetish for Asian culture or Asian bodies, especially as the stylized images are generally far removed from exclusively Japanese attributes, hair color, eye shape, proportions, etc. It's all fantasy, and a lot of people who use this material actually have little interest in real-life women. Well, there's no way to read this extra-long email on the show, LOL, but I just want to give you a little more food for thought regarding the case and the relevance of porn. So, well, surprise, Laura, we are reading it.
We are.
Yeah.
And we learned stuff.
That's why I had to read it, because we learned a lot.
Which was great.
Just like the last one. Very educational.
Absolutely. So good feedback.
Yes, that was very good. So before we say goodbye, I want to remind listeners about how much we appreciate your comments and suggestions. And we would love to get them in voicemail form, just saying. If you want to leave us an email, that's good, but a voice recording is even better. Just go to our website and click on Leave Us a Voicemail. Also, I just wanted to remind you that we've added a new episode to our Members Only podcast feed just this past week. It's about Jill Cahill. This is a really unbelievable story about a husband who beat his wife to the brink of death, and due to failures in our system, I believe, to protect domestic violence victims, he was able to get at her again, ultimately killing her. I really thought that was a fascinating case.
It was.
Of our members-only episodes, that I think was one of my favorites. So that wraps it up, Dick.
That's it for today.
So goodbye until next time, and we will see you then at the quiet end.
We'll save a seat for you.